The Algerian War of Independence was especially brutal, killing thousands of French and hundreds of thousands of Algerians. Fanon was a leading voice calling for independence not only for Algeria, but for all of Africa. He died in 1961, a few months before Algeria became free, and in the same year that Obama was born. Fanon's work enjoyed a vogue in the West in the late 1960s through the 1970s, especially in schools and universities where young people were mobilizing against the Vietnam War. No wonder Obama discovered Fanon and absorbed his ideas. It solidified his worldview and confirmed his intense hatred for colonialism and neo-colonialism. Fanon argued that colonialism and neo-colonialism are total systems that are, in their inherent structure, evil. The form of colonialism may vary, but even so, exploitation, tortures, raids, collective liquidations take turns at different levels in order literally to make of the native an object in the hands of the occupying nation. Addressing French liberals who defended colonialism but condemned its excesses, Fanon wrote, "Torture in Algeria is not an accident or an error or a fault. Colonialism cannot be understood without the possibility of torturing, of violating, of massacring." Racism, Fanon argued, was a characteristic feature of colonialism. Not that colonial systems required it, but typically they found it a convenient way to rationalize why the occupiers were on top and the rest were at the bottom. Racism enabled the bad guys to feel good about being bad, to enjoy a sense of entitlement to their violent and exploitative behavior. Recall that this analysis of racism is very similar to the one we derived from Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness. Even so, Fanon recognized that racism is only one element of a vaster whole, that of the systemized oppression of a people. Fanon also insisted that colonialism could not be reformed. It had to be totally overturned and eliminated. Fanon wrote that every Frenchman in Algeria is at the present time an enemy soldier, even if that Frenchman did not work for the colonial authorities and considered himself uninvolved in colonial oppression. In other words, you were either on the side of oppression or on the side of liberation. There is no middle ground. This is a war to the finish. One side must win and the other must lose. The struggle is at once total and absolute. Liberation is the total destruction of the colonial system. Fanon's strategy for eliminating colonialism was violence. "The native is ready for violence at all times," Fanon wrote. "Only through a murderous and decisive struggle could colonialism be overthrown." Fanon said that colonized man is an envious man. He wants to destroy the colonial system, or to wring the neo-colonialism out of every institution of society. In Fanon's view, the hidden desire of the colonized is to replicate the crimes of the colonizer. "The native is an oppressed person whose permanent dream is to become the persecutor." Is this also Obama's dream? I think it is, and this helps to explain Obama's friendship and association with the radical activist Bill Ayers. As a member of the Weather Underground, Ayers participated in the bombings of the New York City Police Headquarters in 1970, the Capitol Building in 1971, and the Pentagon in 1972. Ayers, now a professor of education at the University of Illinois at Chicago, held a fundraiser for Obama at his apartment in 1995 when Obama made his first run for the Illinois State Senate. The two formed an acquaintance, which deepened into a friendship when they served jointly on the board of an educational foundation, the Woods Fund. Ayers and Obama also worked together for 6 years, from 1995 to 2001, on a multi-million-dollar educational grant program called the Chicago-Annenberg Challenge. During the presidential campaign, Obama's media spokesman pooh-poohed the idea that Obama bore any responsibility for what Ayers did in the early 1970s when Obama was only a child. Yet the issue wasn't what Ayers did then, but how he feels about it now. A few years ago, Ayers told the New York Times that, "I don't regret setting bombs. I feel we didn't do enough. Asked if he might do it again, he answered, I don't want to discount the possibility. Even so, Obama counted Ayers a supporter and a friend. Surely this is not because Obama himself would contemplate bombing the Pentagon. That would be quite a first for a U.S. president. So what's going on here? In a letter to the Times, Ayers said that his actions must be understood in the context of the Vietnam War. The story of his activism, he said, begins literally in the shadow of Hiroshima and comes of age in the killing fields of Southeast Asia. Read Ayers' memoir, Fugitive Days, and the anti-colonial themes jump out at you. Of the Weathermen, Ayers writes, We had been insistent in our anti-Americanism, our opposition to a national story stained with conquest and slavery and attempted genocide. Vietnam, Ayers writes, was the cause that spurred him to action. What kind of a system is it that allows the U.S. to seize the destinies of the Vietnamese people? Today, we think of the Vietnam War as America's attempt to stop communism. But that's not how Ho Chi Minh saw it, and that's not how Bill Ayers saw it either. For Ho and Bill, this was an anti-colonial struggle. Vietnam was a French colony, and when the French encountered guerrilla resistance in that country, they solicited and received American aid. In 1954, in the wake of the disaster at Dien Bien Phu, the French pulled out, and the Americans stepped in to fill the gap. Ayers accurately notes that Americans tended to view Vietnam as a domino. If Vietnam falls, all of Indochina will fall in short order. Ayers accepted the logic of dominoes, but read it in the other direction. If America is permitted to impose neocolonialism on Vietnam, soon it will take it upon itself to occupy the rest of Southeast Asia, and who knows what after that. Ayers believed he was using violence in a noble cause, the cause of halting American neocolonialism in Vietnam. With this background information, it is easy to see why Obama should admire Ayers. They are fellow anti-colonial warriors, even if Obama himself eschews violence. Obama, of course, made the same intellectual compromise with Fanon, embracing his anti-colonial cause while rejecting his call to violence. Fanon advocated violence on the grounds that oppressors never concede power without a fight. He was all in favor of the oppressed exchanging places with the oppressor and giving the bad guys a taste of their own medicine. At the same time, Fanon insisted that the colonized should not imitate the racism or even the race consciousness of the oppressor. In Fanon's view, colonialism was rooted in racism, but anti-colonialism needed to transcend tribal and racial boundaries. Fanon's reason for rejecting race and color consciousness was eminently practical. Since the colonizers had incomparably greater resources and also the best weapons, the colonized needed massive numbers to make up for what they lacked in resources and firepower. Fanon called for the unity of the oppressed. He sought initially to unite the various African tribes and nationalities into a joint African resistance. Ultimately, he envisioned the possibility of the black, brown, and yellow races coming together in a global front against white European supremacy. Fanon even saw the possibility of a few white European sympathizers who might join the liberationist cause. In Fanon's case, the most prominent was the philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre, who wrote the introduction to Fanon's The Wretched of the Earth. Obama embraced Fanon's call for a transracial and even non-racial politics of resistance, but he seems to have seen a possibility that Fanon missed, or perhaps one that was not available in Fanon's time but became available in Obama's time. This was the possibility that went beyond forming a coalition of the oppressed. It involved winning a substantial number, perhaps a majority, of whites over to the cause of anti-colonial politics. If this could be done, it would eliminate the need for violence. Indeed, it would be a feat of political diplomacy to be able to recruit your enemy to participate in his own overthrow. Still, how to do this? Curiously, Obama may have found the answer in Fanon, right in the very same passages where Obama pirated his Life magazine story. In Black Skin, White Masks, Fanon spoke of laboratories that were searching for a denegrification serum, a serum that would turn black people white. He also wrote of West Indian black women who were determined to marry a white man with blue eyes, in part so they could have lighter children. Fanon called this phenomenon lactification. The term, which comes from milk, means whitening. Fanon's point wasn't merely that blacks sought greater social prestige by being associated with a lighter skin color. Rather, it was that lactification was a metaphor for the way in which colonized people deny their own heritage and seek to copy the ways of their oppressors. Fanon mocked the Africans and West Indians who learned, without irony, French poems about our ancestors, the Gauls. For Fanon, lactification doesn't just refer to looking white, it also refers to acting white, to people with black skin who seek to put on white masks. As Fanon put it, the more the colonized has assimilated the cultural values of the metropolis, the more he will have escaped the bush. The more he rejects his blackness and the bush, the whiter he will become. Here Obama seems to have had an original idea that turned Fanon on his head. Obama's idea was, what's wrong with putting on the white mask? Let's clarify the difficulty facing Obama. In the last chapter, we saw how Obama benefited from Saul Alinsky's transracial strategy to assemble an effective coalition. Alinsky's goal was for the activist to reach America's white middle class because, as he put it, that is where the power is. Alinsky had nothing but contempt for left-wing activists who treated the white middle class as a bunch of square, sexually uptight, gun-toting, small-minded racists. Yes, Alinsky wrote, the middle class is mighty screwed up, but it has become that way because it's desperate. Its economic condition is deteriorating, and so people turn to guns and religion to give them consolation. Sound familiar? Alinsky advocated that a successful activist must not disdain the middle class, but rather join it. Certainly, he wasn't calling for an embrace of the provincial values of the middle class. Rather, he urged that activists adopt the style and attitude of the middle class. If the middle class is square, then be square. Don't wear the black leather jacket and the hippie bandana. Wear a suit and tie. Don't come across as an angry misfit. Come across as a nice young man who is only upset because of manifest injustice. Smile a lot. Smiles are a great way to disguise rage and contempt. In this way, Alinsky argued, the activist could build a rapport with ordinary Americans and mobilize them on behalf of radical causes. Obama's genius was to figure out a simple but effective way to achieve both Fanon's goal of advancing the anti-colonial vision and also Alinsky's goal to win over mainstream America. Obama knew from his experience at Columbia and at Harvard that there was an immense fund of white racist shame that had given rise to an equally large fund of white racial guilt. This guilt was ready to be tapped, and in Chicago, Obama saw how it was being tapped by Jesse Jackson and his fellow shakedown artists. But what if it could be tapped in a much bigger and more consequential way? Author Shelby Steele, one of America's most insightful commentators on race relations, notes that whites have been looking for some time for a black leader who has credibility within the black community and yet can offer whites racial absolution. This should not be taken too cynically. Many whites genuinely espouse an idealism that seeks to move beyond race, and they recognize that it's going to take a black spokesman to make this case on a national level and help us get there. Steele notes bluntly that this idealism cannot be divorced from a powerful sense of white racial guilt. We have to get beyond race because America's past racial history has become such an embarrassment. Now, the black leader that whites are looking for does not actually have to issue indulgences in the manner of the medieval papacy. Rather, by his words and deeds, he can signal to white America that whites are no longer on the hook for past racism. In Steele's view, whites have been eagerly, hungrily awaiting the black leader who would give them a chance, through their support of his leadership, not merely to say to others, but to feel in their innermost being, "Whew, I am not a racist."